Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
So after a good month for Tottenham, it's time to see if they can make it stick in March as they get ready to welcome back Antonio Conte. But who is the man who has guided them to their first win over Chelsea since January 2017 and their best home form since April 2019? I'm talking, of course, about Christian Stellini. I'm Mark Chapman. This is the Athletic Football Podcast.
We are in a momentum that the player has to take responsibility to follow this momentum.
For them to have won those games, it represents a bit of a turning of the corner, I think.
We have to try all together to do our best. If our best would be win a trophy, we have to show into the pitch.
I think it's quite embarrassing that Spurs haven't won a trophy for so long, to be honest.
Unless there is a big turnaround, I expect Conte not to be the manager next season.
So joining us for this one, The Athletic's Tottenham writers, Jack Pitbrook and Tim Spears. Let me start, Jack. My intro said after a good month. Is that what it takes now to do a whole Tottenham podcast? Just one good month and the bunting is out.
They won four league games out of five, Chappers, since they won at Craven Cottage at the end of January. They kept four clean sheets. It's amazing how much their bad form and, frankly, unwatchable football in the first half of the season has lowered the bar in such a way that Tottenham showing, you know, to be fair to them, quite a lot of competence in the last few weeks and beating Man City and Chelsea. And I know Chelsea are very bad at the moment, but City are obviously pretty good. For them to have won those games is just, it represents a bit of a turning of the corner, I think, given how badly they were at the start of the season.
Does the mood of the fan base, Tim, suggest that they are turning the corner? I can't quite work. I don't feel like Tottenham fans are necessarily cartwheeling down the street, albeit they are delighted at their wins over Manchester City and Chelsea.
Yeah, I mean, I love how everything's turned and February was amazing. And yet I went to watch them at Leicester, produced definitely one of the worst performances Spurs must have produced in years. I mean, they should have lost 6 or 7-1 that day. So, you know, they've still got that in them. I thought the atmosphere was really interesting against Chelsea at the weekend. You know, I'd heard a lot leading up to the game about how sort of frightened Spurs were of Chelsea and had a real inferiority complex. Rightly so, after sort of, you know, decades of barely beating them. They hadn't scored against them in the stadium. They obviously hadn't beaten them in the new stadium. It wasn't really a feeling of sort of ecstasy and huge celebration at full time. I did think it'd be a little bit louder. There's definitely caution about getting carried away, and given this season's performances and results, that's fair enough. Don't feel like Spurs are ever more than a week or maybe a day away from a crisis. There's always something around the corner. But there's also a lot of uncertainty in terms of off-field things. So Conte's future is, you know, very much up in the air. It's not like maybe things have been in the past under Pochettino, or maybe, you know, not far down the road at Arsenal, where, you know, they're really building towards something and this is a long-term project and everyone's heavily invested in this. You know, that's not the case, because Conte's contract's up in the summer, and there's definitely issues with the ownership as well. I mean, it wasn't so long ago they were very vocal, you know, anti-Daniel Levy chants. That was only in January. So, yeah, great to see them in a bit of form. It's long overdue, but, yeah, nobody's getting carried away.
Where are we at with Antonio Conte at the moment, Jack? A man who has had a very difficult year, personally.
Yeah, he's had a really tough year. I mean, he has lost three people very close to him, one of whom Gianpiero Ventrone, who'd worked for him at Tottenham as he had in previous jobs. And now he has been, he's been pretty ill. Like, he, you know, the surgery he had is not minor. It's not a minor illness. It's not minor surgery. And clearly, you know, it's kept him out of work for weeks. In terms of his contract, well, his contract expires at the end of the season. There have been talks earlier this season about a new contract. There is an option, but I think it's unlikely that the option would be... It's unclear in whose favour the option is, and I think it's unlikely that the option would be taken up if Conte could not agree a new deal. Tottenham would not want to keep Conte at the club against his will. So, unless there is a big turnaround, or both parties change their position somewhat, I expect Conte not to be the manager next season. I don't expect him to sign a new deal which would keep him there for next year.
Tim, would you agree?
There certainly haven't been any signs to contradict that, and Conte will talk about a project, but he also talks about it being a project he's not used to. And, you know, we've certainly seen with Juventus and Inter and Chelsea where there have been almost title-ready teams there for him to mould, whereas that's not the case here. This is a long-term project. You know, Spurs' very good financial results came out a couple of weeks ago, and there's an interesting line in the statement that Levy put out about sort of being proud that the average age of signings is now 23. That's what we're looking at here, and that doesn't exactly fit with someone like Antonio Conte, who also, I think, even... From his point of view, I mean, he's spoken a bit, you know, obviously Jack mentioned there, you know, how he's lost three people close to him this season, and he's been candid in press conferences and said, you know, maybe he should spend more time at home with his family, and, you know, things like what's happened to him this year has made him realise that. So, yeah, it doesn't feel necessarily too acrimonious between him and the chairman and the ownership, but it feels like more of just a natural parting of the ways this summer.
So who is the man then that has been standing in for him? Because he's done actually, when he stood in for him before, Inter Milan, when he stood in for him, he won both games there. You look at what's happened at Tottenham, and the Leicester game that Tim went to, actually Stellini wasn't in charge for. Conte was back for that. But the win over Marseille in November, the win over Manchester City, the win over West Ham, the win over Chelsea, Jack, he has been in charge for.
Yeah, and I don't think it's completely coincidental. I think that Conte is very intense, clearly, and he's very demanding, and he's not necessarily a manager who is big on arm around the shoulder of a player if they're struggling, that sort of thing. And that means that, you know, there's obviously Conte is an incredible coach, one of the best in the world, but when results are bad, when performances are bad, I think players' confidence drops, and Conte isn't especially good at recovering the confidence of players who are struggling. Whereas Stellini obviously comes at this from a different angle. He's spoken about this himself. As an assistant manager, he's obviously closer to the players than Conte is. I think he's a bit better at giving, you know, putting that arm around the shoulder. And I do think we have seen players who were not playing very well in the first half of the season are starting to play a bit better. Eric Dier being case in point. I also think that Conte's absence has encouraged a bit more. It's kind of changed the decision-making process a bit at Tottenham. You know, Conte's a very autocratic manager. You know, everything is his way. It's not up for discussion or debate. He just tells people how it's going to be. And again, these are methods which have had great success, so I'm not criticising the methods inherently. But take him out of the picture. If you take the autocrat out of an autocracy, and it changes the dynamic. And what's replaced him, I think, is a more autonomous decision-making process. Players are taking responsibility, coaches are taking responsibility, and all the players have had to raise their level a bit to fill that gap. So I do think that, I'm not saying that Tottenham are worse with Conte, but I do think that the specific circumstances of Conte's absence this time has actually allowed the team to maybe loosen up a bit and grow a bit.
Yeah, it just seems calmer, doesn't it, Tim?
Yeah, I think a really interesting case in point is Emerson Royale, who for my mind must be the most improved player in the Premier League this year. I mean, it's been remarkable how he's gone from one extreme to the other. I mean, the guy was, you know, a walking calamity, to be honest. I find it incredible that he's been, you know, Tottenham's first choice right wing back for the majority of this season. Like, astonishing. And yet he's completely flipped that on his head this year. And I do wonder if, when Emerson Royale plays no-look passes that go behind for a goal kick or hits shots that literally leave the stadium at Bournemouth. I don't think Antonio Conte is the kind of guy that will sit him down and say, it's okay. Like, you know, just keep going. Think things will get better. Put his arm around the shoulder. Whereas I think Emerson Royal is the kind of player who needs that. He needs a bit of love. And Stellini's probably given him that. And it's probably no coincidence that his form has improved.
Do you think as basic as that is? Because, you know, when you talk to former players who are fullbacks in particular, right? And they always talk about how the half that they are on the opposite side to the dugout is a much better half for them than the half when they are next to the dugout, because they're getting so much of the manager's thoughts in their ear. Do you think it could be as simple as that?
It could be, yeah. I remember Tony Pulis saying that he used to switch Adama Traore's wings, depending on which half he's playing, because he needed to coach him through the whole game on the flip side of that. But I think, well, certainly with Real, they seem to have simplified his game. I mean, wing-back's such a massive position for a Conte team, and he's had an overload of things to do in defence and attack. And I think they've told him, you know, don't worry about crossing the ball as much, and don't worry about balls in the final third as much. Just worry about defending. So I think they have modified his game slightly. And I think one other important point to make in all of this, when we're talking about Tottenham's form, is that they had this incredible schedule, as a lot of teams playing in Europe did, before the World Cup. So they had no free midweeks all through October and November. They played 13 games in 43 days, which is, you know, and their form was all over the place, and the injuries and selection were all over the place. So that's the 13 games before the World Cup, 43 days. 13 games since the World Cup have been over 63 days. So that's a full 3 weeks of extra training and rest. And with the squad that Tottenham have got, which isn't comparable to the teams that they're trying to compete with in terms of its size and strength, that's been really important, especially with so many players out of form, players like Richarlison, who still hasn't scored in the Premier League yet. You know, they haven't got a wealth of attacking players to rotate who are in form. So having that settled 11 and more time on the training ground has definitely helped.
I know the majority of people listening to this will probably be Tottenham fans who will probably agree with you there, Tim, but do you really think their squad is much weaker than the teams that they are trying to compete with? When you look at, you know, if you put City and Arsenal ahead of everybody else, and they're trying to compete for third and fourth with Manchester United and Newcastle at the moment, and if I was being really mischievous, I'd throw Fulham in there because I think they're six at the time of us recording this. But their squad's better than Newcastle's.
No, it is. I would say, maybe, I probably should have said clubs that they're trying to compete with rather than teams there, I think. As right. In clubs like Chelsea.
Where they view themselves.
I think so, yeah. I mean, honestly, as recently as January, they didn't have a single attacker on their bench for one league game. Ryan Sessegnon was the most attacking player. I think it was for Villa at home. So, you know, they've tried to rectify that with a couple of January additions. But really, you know, when you compare Chelsea's bench at the weekend, I mean, me and Jack were having a bit of a laugh trying to remember which of these players had played for Chelsea, and there's a couple of players we didn't remember were even there who suddenly appeared on the pitch. Spurs definitely haven't got that kind of luxury.
Yeah, I don't think any other club can compare themselves to Chelsea at the moment. Just a final one on the Stellini-Conte relationship. Is your understanding that Conte is very much still involved and hands-on whilst recuperating? So actually what we're looking at is how the message is delivered as maybe being the difference, which is what you both alluded to.
Yeah, I think Stellini is basically on the phone all the time. I think maybe immediately after the surgery it was harder for him to be that involved, but now I think he speaks to Stellini constantly through the day, you know, morning, even late into the night. He gets feedback on every training session. He basically picks the team, I think. Stellini will even speak to Conte at half-time so that Conte can tell him exactly what instructions to give the players for the second half. So it's not as if Conte has, even though Conte isn't physically there, it's not as if Stellini has total autonomy to run things himself. You know, Conte is very much pulling the strings in the background.
You wonder if they continue. I mean, this isn't going to happen, but it would be really interesting to see if Conte decides to, if Conte was to sit in the, you know, director's box or higher up in the stand to get that, which I always think gives you a better view of a game anyhow than being touchline, to be honest with you, and gets a real tactical view of it. but his message is delivered by the calmer Stellini. It would be how you got a smile on you for both of you got a smile on your face. It would be really interesting to see how that played out, because to all intents and purposes, that's what's happening at the moment.
I think Conte would burst with frustration if he had to, given how he likes to micromanage the game. Every single tackle, pass, movement off the ball, he would he wouldn't be able to get his head around the idea that he would be so far he wouldn't be able to communicate with the players. I think it would drive him crazy.
Yeah, it's a really interesting dynamic, and you've got to pay tribute to Stellini for stepping up. He clearly hates doing the media game. I mean, there's so many media commitments to fulfil. I don't think him and Conte are particularly sort of bosom buddies or that close, but he's handled it really well. He's not been treading on anyone's toes. He's quite open about things like player improvement and development, which is quite refreshing from a sort of a press conference point of view. And he does give the odd sort of fascinating nugget. I was interested to hear him say last Friday before the Chelsea game that he'd been studying Graham Potter at Brighton and really admired him as a manager. And he was kind of asked, why is that? And he said he really liked his versatility and how he enlists a lot of different formations in matches, and how you never know what you're going to get against the Graham Potter team. I was like, well, he clearly didn't tell Conte that, because he plays exactly the same system and pretty much the same tactics every single week.
Right. In the next part of this podcast, we'll talk the wider state of Tottenham and also their quest for a trophy.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Jack Pitbrook and Tim Spears, our Tottenham writers, are with us today. We are recording this, Tim, before the FA Cup tie with Sheffield United. There is a second leg against AC Milan to come as well next week. Which is more important? Which should be more important?
I mean, to a club like Spurs, the Champions League has to be more of a priority. And they've reached the final in pretty recent times. But obviously, realistically, the FA Cup is, especially with how the draws opened up a little bit this year. They've generally, this is a kiss of death here, and people who listen to this tomorrow will find this hilarious if Spurs have lost. But they've generally only lost to the sort of the top end Premier League teams this season. Arsenal twice, City, Newcastle, Man United, lost to Liverpool. They just had a couple of wobbles, one against Leicester, one against Villa, but generally they will dispatch of poorer teams. If they get through against Sheffield United, they've got a decent chance. My one concern in terms of fighting for a trophy for Spurs this season is that they're looking incapable of fighting on three fronts. As mentioned earlier with the squad rotation, I mean, they've struggled to fight on one front at times this season, let alone three. If you remember last season when they sort of charged into the top four, they were already out of Europe. That had happened before Christmas, and then they lost in the FA Cup to Middlesbrough on this day, I think it was March the 1st. And then they ended the season with 11 wins in 14 and kind of got on this roll of picking the same team every week and generally winning every week. So if they're still in both of those cup competitions in the next few weeks, then they're going to have to start making priorities, because they just haven't got the squad to compete on multiple fronts.
Okay, let me pick up on that. Do you think that the best one to compare them to at the moment is maybe Manchester United, who aren't actually rotating that much, are they? And are still competing on all their fronts as well. So would they be best to look to them as an example and just go for it and see what happens? Or is that too risky or just not Tottenham?
I just don't feel like they've got enough players in good form. You know, you take Harry Kane's goals out of it. They are mid-table. They really are. I mean, we mentioned Richarlison hasn't scored since September the 7th. And, okay, Son's sort of crept up to 9 goals. But 3 of those, 7 of those have come in 3 games. He scored a hat-trick against Leicester. He got 2 against Frankfurt and he got 2 against Preston. Other than that, he's scored in very, very few games this year. Kulusevski's only scored twice. I mean, this is your front line. Perisic has been dropped recently because his attacking output hasn't been good enough. So the defence has improved lately, and I think a lot of that's to do with the extra time on the training ground, as we discussed earlier. But, you know, you look at how many important players have taken Manchester United to a trophy. I just don't see that level at Spurs at the moment.
Jack?
I think a big part of the issue here is that Conte's strengths have always been league football. Like, he's always been about play the same guys every single week, every single league game, and we'll get a lot of points. You know, that was the foundation of his successes at Juve, Inter and Chelsea. And even the second half of last season with Tottenham. He's not someone who... He only really wants to have about 12 players in his squad. He's not someone like, you know, like Guardiola and Klopp have shown over the last 5 years, who have the capacity to rotate between a sort of 15, 16-man squad to play, you know, to a high standard multiple times a week in different competitions. That's just not really the Conte approach. And so I think the chances... I mean, look, it's great that Tottenham are, at the time of recording, in 3 competitions. And you'd have to say the chance of them winning the Champions League are low. And, I mean, the Premier League, I think the best they can do is probably 4th. But I think that, realistically, I think they probably will have to prioritise. I asked Stellini in the press conference yesterday, you know, what will your priority be over the last phase of the season? He said, well, we don't prioritise, we just want to win every game, which is what managers always say. But I think they will struggle to maintain that assault on all 3 fronts between now and the end of May.
Fans must look, Jack, I keep coming back to Newcastle and Manchester United, but fans must look at that League Cup final and the atmosphere of the League Cup final and the interest in the League Cup final. I think, blimey, we want some of... I mean, I know Tottenham spent a lot of time at Wembley, but they must think like that. And I know the danger is you always come out in the quarterfinals away at Manchester City and you think that's probably that. But Tottenham fans must look at it and think, blimey, we could be in the FA Cup final here.
Yeah, it is weird that they've only had... I mean, since they won the League Cup in 2008, I think they've been in 3 other League Cup finals off the top of my head. One the first year after 2009, 2015 which they lost, 2015 which they lost, and then 2021 which they lost. But it was one of the first games back after COVID, so there are only a few thousand people there, so it doesn't really feel like a proper fans' day out. So and they haven't been in an FA Cup final for a long time either. So. It is quite strange that a team which has been, you know, routinely finished in the top 4 or certainly in the top 6 has been to so few domestic finals. And I'm sure that Tottenham fans do feel a bit of a sense of, you know, when's our big day out?
You've written on it though, on The Athletic, about Tottenham and winning trophies. Not winning trophies, actually.
Well, yeah, so there's certainly a big group of Spurs fans for whom the lack of trophies is a sort of damning judgment against Enoch. So, you know, you'll see banners saying longest trophy drought for 70 years at games. And so to some fans, it is hugely important. Other fans might say, well, we've had some pretty good times over the last 15 years, you know, the Harry Redknapp years, the Pochettino years. Football's not only about trophies, it's about the journey as well. I know this is something that some Spurs fans do feel very strongly. And I know that at the top of the club, the priority is not always to win a cup for the sake of winning a cup. It's about, you know, building the brand. It's not a nice phrase, but that is kind of the view. Being in the Champions League, which they've done repeatedly over the last few years, securing the long-term future of the club through building the right infrastructure and everything. So it's not just about winning a cup. I mean, if it was just about winning a cup, then, you know, Wigan Athletic would currently be in better nick than Tottenham Hotspur, and Wigan are struggling and Tottenham are in the Champions League.
But the Wigan fans who went to Wembley and won the FA Cup would take that and accept the relegation from the Premier League every single time. I haven't spoken to them all, but I'm fairly sure about that. How the club has post Dave Whelan is a different subject.
But that's not to say that Tottenham fans would exchange their last 10 years for those of Wigan. And if you'd say to Tottenham fans, okay, well, we'll give you the 2013 FA Cup, but at the cost of which we'll have the whole... There won't be a Pochettino era, there won't be Ajax, there won't be Champions League final in Madrid, all the rest of it. So it's not... I don't think that... It's not certain to me that fans are... Put it like this. There's a broad range of views amongst the fans, and they don't all care... quite the same way about the trophy drought issue.
And Jack has mentioned this word, and I kind of want to hit myself over the head, Tim, before even asking this question. But, you know, Enoch would say that the brand is very strong.
Ugh, it's horrible, isn't it? Yeah, I don't know. I think it's quite embarrassing that Spurs haven't won a trophy for so long, to be honest. Even allowing for all the off-field success, you know, the teams that they've had, the managers they've had, the players they've had. They've had Mourinho and Conte, you know, Harry Kane, one of the best strikers the game's ever seen. To not win a trophy, yeah, I'd be angry if I was a Spurs fan. But that's just how I support a team. I think the game is all about glory and winning trophies, and that's what you should be striving to do at the cost of anything else.
Although they have, I mean, you know, everybody says this, the stadium is amazing. And actually, as a fan, to get to go to a stadium where you are looked after as you are, I mean, you know, you have to pay for it, obviously, is very nice, shall we say. And what the club have done in developing their ties with other sports has to be applauded. The NFL, they've announced this week as well, haven't they, that they're building a karting track under the stadium as well. I mean, you on a business level, you do have to applaud some of the partnerships that they have. Beyonce's there this summer, isn't she, as well? You have to applaud the partnerships they've gone into.
Yeah.
That they've built.
Definitely to be applauded. And, you know, as I mentioned in the accounts earlier, they'll be on for record revenues this year. You know, they are catching up with the clubs they're trying to compete with. And it is very impressive. The press release for that F1 karting thing.
Oh my God.
What does it say?
Can I read it? Because honestly, this is up there with the old, we've got a billion followers on Facebook, so it doesn't matter whether we win anything line that's come from another club that I've mentioned several times. But honestly, this paragraph, with music concerts, boxing and rugby now also being staged in London N17, it means an estimated 5.9 billion people globally are interested in events held at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. That equates to nearly 80% of the world's population. Now, you can decide whether they meant this or not, but to suggest that 80% of the world's population are interested in what's going on at the Tottenham Stadium is some stretch.
My favourite reply to that tweet was that, oh, they sell water at the stadium, so 8 billion people must be interested. yeah, that was ludicrous. But this is it. This is owners versus fans and priorities. I mean, even when I was covering Wolves Chappers, it was the same. That they didn't seem that particularly bothered about winning a trophy. It was all about growing the brand, even at a club like Wolves, you know, and opportunities overseas and esports and fashion and whatnot. So, yeah, the transformation has been impressive. You know, when I was growing up, Spurs were always a cup team who were mostly hilariously bad in the league and went through, you know, some really awful managers. And it's completely flipped now. You know, they're no longer a cup team, but they have a very good record in the league over the past 10 years. You know, they'll always be top six or thereabouts. It's just about getting that balance now between consistency and winning.
What you would say about that statement, I mean, it is very easy to laugh at it, and we have done that, Jack. But in an era of financial fair play and a look at ownership models and so on and so forth, and how much revenue you bring into the club, a statement and a press release like that will attract the eyes and ears of businesses around the world. And they still don't have a stadium title sponsor, which I'm assuming they're still looking for. I haven't seen anything announced on that. So building their commercial revenues, if it goes into the team, is vital in an era where countries are buying other football teams.
Yeah, I think Daniel Levy deserves a huge amount of respect and credit for the way he's managed this. You know, since Enoch bought Tottenham in 2000 from Alan Sugar, they've had to sit and watch as Roman Abramovich has bought Chelsea, the United Arab Emirates have bought Manchester City, obviously now Saudi Arabia and Newcastle United. It's very, very tough. And, you know, the financial landscape has completely changed. Tottenham might have a benefactor in the sense that they are owned by a billionaire, but they unfortunately it's a billionaire who doesn't put any money in. So Tottenham have got to do it all themselves. They built a stadium themselves. Other teams have been gifted stadiums. Tottenham built a 62,000-seater stadium themselves. That stadium has now produced huge amounts of money. They made, more than £100 million in matchday revenue last season, even though they're only European football with three Europa Conference League games. If you throw on top of that, you know, NFL, the go-karting thing, Beyonce, which they're getting well into eight figures for, both codes of rugby, all sorts. So, you know, there are tons and tons of stuff at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. And that is allowing Tottenham to not, you know, they'll never be able to spend Chelsea, Manchester City money, but they can spend good money on good players despite not being owned by a state or an oligarch, which I think is a minor miracle of financial management and strategy, even though clearly, you know, lots of the football side decisions have been bad decisions. And I'm sure that eventually the type of people who buy football clubs will look at Tottenham as being extremely, extremely attractive because they are, you know, they live within their means. They've got huge revenues via the stadium and the Champions League, with a fifth Champions League place coming to England next year, which we know about. And even though it's easy for us to laugh at that press release, because it is quite laughable, I'm sure that's the kind of thing that will, you know, was written, I imagine that was written to get in front of the type of investors that might consider spending, you know, let's say £4 billion on Tottenham Hotspur one day.
Finally, fans tend to, what you want from football as a fan is those shared experiences. And you know you're going to get some horrible days, and hopefully you're going to get some great days as well. When you look at Tottenham right now, they've been in the top flight since 1978. They've been in Europe for 16 of the last 17 seasons. Since they won the 2008 League Cup, their worst league finish is eighth. It was always about top four, wasn't it? Remember Lasagna Gate and all of that. Well, they've now finished in the top four, seven of the last 14 years. Every individual measures success in a different way. Fans, managers, players, owners, board members, whoever it may be. But when you look at that biography, Tim, you go first and then Jack, they've had a lot of good experiences.
Yeah, definitely. You know, you look at the 20 years since the turn of the century, you know, before and after, it's completely different. And the line in the sand there is Enoch buying the club in 2001. So there are, yeah, it depends how you view football, I think, Chappers, and it's a really interesting question. Yeah. You know, would you swap all that for a League Cup win? Common sense says absolutely not, but football isn't run by common sense. And lots of fans would say, you know, okay, great, we haven't won, but, you know, great, we can go go-karting and go see Red Hot Chili Peppers, and yeah, fantastic, but what's that got to do with football? But as Jack rightly says, you know, what the ownership have done has to be applauded.
It depends how you view football, as Tim said, and everybody views it differently, Jack.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, just as there are some fans for whom the failure to win a trophy is embarrassing and painful, and I think that, and I get that, because it is kind of weird that a team has been this take a step back. This is a team that's been consistently good for the last 15 years. Better, more consistent, really, than they've been at any point for a long time. And yet, they haven't got over the line and won a trophy. Equally, there are other fans who are more willing to take the pleasure from those good league performances. They've had some great players at the club. They've had some good, you know, they've had some great European occasions, and they're, you know, they're happier to take their pleasure from that. So, Yeah, like I said, there's a, not, I wouldn't say a divide, but I would say a sort of broad range of views amongst the Tottenham fan base on this particular point.
Plenty more on this and everything else in football on The Athletic. Head to theathletic.com/footballpod. If you're not a subscriber yet, the latest offer is £1.99 a month for the first 12 months. So athletic.com/footballpod. Jack and Tim have a dedicated Tottenham podcast on The Athletic, View from the Lane. That's out twice a week, and I'm assuming that 80% of the world's population listen to that. That's it. Tim, Jack, thank you. More tomorrow.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.